All right, good evening. I would like to call the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Today's March 6th, 2023. Let the record reflect that it is 6 p.m. Today we have present with us Speaker Kathy Tilton, Representative Gray, Representative McCabe, Representative McKay, Representative Groh, and Representative Fields is here in the audience with us. Thank you all for being here. Please check your cell phones and make sure they're put on silent. Staff today that'll be helping us with the meeting is Lori Rowland from House Records and Zachary Lawhorn from the LIO. My staff, Kendra Broussard, will be the committee aide. We have three items on the agenda tonight. We're going to continue the permanent fund discussions this evening. Last Wednesday, we heard a bill that promotes a permanent fund dividend solution. HB 72 would make the PFD 25% of the POMV draw. It was a 25-75 split option. Tonight we'll have three more options on the table. So without further ado, and I know it's been a long day for all of us, so I will bring up the presenters for HB 90, permanent fund dividend, $1,000 dividend. I will invite Representative Fields to come up and his staff. Will you guys please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation here.
Thanks, Representative Carpenter, Zach Fields, House District 17, and thanks for putting up all these bills for consideration together.
And for the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields.
And I think we're just, okay. Can you all see the screen, or is it loading for y'all too?
No. Do you have slides to put up?
Yes.
Okay, let's take a break and ease. Okay, we're back on the record, and now that we have the slides up, why don't you guys go ahead and present for us? Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Carpenter. Zach Fields here. The impetus for this bill really came out of conversations with colleagues who said, you know, the main issue, what I was hearing from some of these colleagues is the main issue is not the number per se, it's just predictability for a dividend. So I took that to heart and wrote a bill and I paid attention to some of the hearings that you all have had and other bills that people have introduced and legislative finance models. And then I looked back at the history and it was kind of interesting because the first permanent fund dividend back in 1982 of $1,000 is about what we can predictably afford looking out into the out years without raising new taxes. $1,000 is also pretty similar to the historic average. That was kind of an interesting alignment. And of course, there's been a lot of discussion in the legislature about setting the dividend at $1,000 as people foresaw the 1982 formula becoming unaffordable. So wasn't really my idea, but I wanted to put it back on the table as basically the no tax option to have a balanced budget and give Alaskans predictability on a dividend check. So, of course, I think in looking at the dividend, it's worth just a quick refresh on why we have a dividend. And, you know, in 1976, Alaskans overwhelmingly voted to establish the permanent fund, and at the time they did so with a pretty clear intent in the voter pamphlet and in public discussion of turning a non-renewable resource into a renewable resource, which I think is still one of the best ideas to come out of any of the states, really. And shortly thereafter, of course, there was a lot of discussion about the dividend, and a lot of the impetus for the dividend was making Alaskans feel vested in this program as stakeholders so that the permanent fund itself would be protected, grown, and not squandered. And that was a good idea. And of course, there was quite a legal process to get to a point where the courts would uphold the permanent fund dividend with, you know, navigating the issues of residency and so on. But at the end of the day, in 1982, once the legislature went through several permutations of the permanent fund dividend, the first dividend was $1,000. And over the subsequent years, this is just a chart of all the years. I think you have it in your binders. $1,000 is similar to the the historic average for the dividend. I think what's so interesting is you look back, and of course, oil volume was four times greater in 1982. But that formula worked really well for a long time, really up until about 2012, when a combination of declining revenue, declining oil prices, and subsequently a lower oil tax regime meant that we basically couldn't afford 1982 dividends. We really haven't been able to afford 1982 statutory dividends for about 10 years without tapping into savings. And, you know, there have been multiple moments of reckoning, but I think it's pretty clear we won't be able to afford a dividend based on a 1982 formula probably indefinitely into the future without a lot more taxes. And maybe the legislature will choose to create such revenue. I don't think that's likely.
Representative Fields, yes, the previous slide, just for the record, the data that you got from there, the historical data, did that come from the Permanent Fund Corporation or Legislative Finance, or where did you pull that?
My staffer compiled this chart, so I'll turn to him.
For the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep Fields. This is straight from the Permanent Fund Corporation's website.
Thank you very much. Please continue. Oh, Representative McCabe has a question. Why have we paused?
So, yeah, as long as you're on this slide, I might as well ask it here. I was going to wait till the end, but the percent change, that's change year over year.
That is correct.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. So, yeah, just looking at, you know, what we can afford now, what we're likely to be able to afford in the future based on reasonably anticipated oil prices. Of course, we don't know the future, but I think it's clear that the dividends based on the 1982 formula simply are not going to be affordable without significant new tax revenue. We can see that. We've seen discussion around a 50-50 dividend, 50% to dividends, 50% to services. That's not affordable without new taxes, except at super high levels of oil prices. I really commend my colleague, Dan Ortiz, for introducing a 75-25 formula. That may be affordable. Some of the assumptions for affordability without new taxes are, I would say, optimistic. I hope we have all those projections, but we might not in terms of oil prices, in terms of constraints on growth and the cost of services related to inflation. So I introduced this bill to have one in the mix that we can be pretty sure we're going to be able to afford this dividend. We can give Alaskans some predictability, and we can do so while maintaining a low tax regime on individuals and industry. And I should say, in my district, my constituents are very comfortable with me voting for new taxes, provided they're fair for working people. But I just don't think we're going to raise significant revenue as a legislature. So I wanted to put forward a bill that's realistic in the political landscape that we inhabit. So this is some legislative finance division modeling of this bill. And basically, it shows that it's highly likely to be affordable long into the future without new taxes. And this is, we asked legislative finance to do modeling similar to what you've seen on some of the other bills. And to make it simpler, we asked legislative finance division to look at, you know, at what oil prices can we likely afford to pay a $1,000 dividend if we were to say, hey, Alaskans, we're going to pay you a $1,000 dividend. You know, can we reasonably promise that? And I think it's reasonable to anticipate we could have oil prices in this range when you look back over recent history and look in the out year. So I hope it would provide some certainty for people who have been without certainty around the dividend for a long time. So again, this bill is designed to provide dividend predictability for Alaskans. It is designed to fund core services consistent with that constitutional intent of voters as adopted in 1976. I think that's very important to honor the Constitution. And this bill would maintain a low or zero tax burden, a zero tax burden on individuals and a low tax burden on industry. And again, personally, I'm comfortable voting for higher taxes. My constituents are, but I don't think we collectively are going to do that. And I don't want to offer the false promise that, hey, we'll raise your dividend with higher taxes, but not be able to deliver. One thing I would note is that, you know, last year we did an energy price relief payment, and I thought that was a really good idea. And I think that under this structure, if we were to tell Alaskans, hey, we're pretty sure we're going to pay you a $1,000 dividend. If oil prices spiked and we had windfall revenue, I really like the idea of the energy relief. And one of the benefits of it is it's tax-free. So it is a little more effective at getting money into people's pockets. And I think in terms of a buffer against high energy prices, it was a good policy and one that would certainly not be off the table in the future. I think, you know, one other thing to think about in the context of this bill is we had kind of a public debate about rewriting our Constitution, and some of the proponents of rewriting said we should put a dividend in there, a large dividend, and Alaskans voted no on rewriting the Constitution. And to me, that's an indication that, you know, what's in there is broadly supported, and it really is on us to change the dividend statute. So that's the background of the bill, and thanks for hearing in the context of many others.
Okay, thank you. I think at this time, can we step through the mechanics of the bill on what it actually does? Maybe that's a sectional analysis or...
Sure.
Thank you.
Absolutely. For the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields. I'll walk us through the sectional analysis for House Bill 90. So similar to Rep. Ortiz's bill that we saw, that you saw in this committee last week, this bill amends the 1982 formula. So Section 1 amends AS 37.13.140, defining the net income of the Alaska Permanent Fund as income of the earnings reserve account, and it leaves unchanged the 5% POMV draw for appropriations. Section 2 amends AS 37.13.145B to authorize the legislature to appropriate funds from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund each year and to pay out a dividend of up to $1,000 to each eligible individual per fiscal year. Section 3 amends AS 37.13.145C to give the legislature the ability to appropriate additional funds from the earnings reserve account to the principal of the permanent fund in order to offset the effect of inflation during that fiscal year. This is consistent with existing statutes that currently allow for inflation proofing. Section 4 amends AS 37.13.145D, replacing the words distribution and the word transfer with the word appropriation to conform with previous section. This is something we'll see throughout the bill. There's a number of conforming changes that were made by drafted in that way by legislative legal to better to update the statute in a way that it needs to be updated to comply with recent litigation. Section 5 amends AS 37.13.145F, which gives the legislature the authority to appropriate funds from the earnings reserve account to the general fund. Section 6 amends AS 37.13.300C, making conforming changes to the statute that disallows the legislature from including income from the Mental Health Trust Fund in the funds available for appropriation. Section 7 makes a conforming change to AS 43.23.025A, which determines the value of the permanent fund dividend. Section 8 repeals AS 37.13.145E, which had previously or had currently mandates a 50% draw on the earnings reserve account for annual dividend payments. And finally, Section 9 provides for an immediate effective date.
Okay. Thank you very much. Pause here for questions on the sectional from committee members. Seeing none. All right. I see you've got a fiscal note in here. Can you step us through that briefly? It looks like a zero fiscal note, so it should be fairly easy.
Yeah. What I saw from Department of Revenue in terms of a fiscal note was an indeterminate fiscal note. Moving forward, they're setting one specific dollar amount in statute could in the future lead to budget surplus. It could also lead to budget the opposite of a deficit. So with that in mind, they're not in a position to make a fiscal note. So it was a zeroed out indeterminate fiscal note from revenue.
Okay. Thank you. Questions on the fiscal note from... Okay. Representative Groh, it looks like you have a question other than the fiscal note. Go right ahead, sir.
So, Representative Fields, thank you very much for putting in this bill. I'm glad to see a substantial number of measures coming forward. I want to thank again the chair for scheduling these measures to address our state structural deficit. I had a few questions. One had to do with inflation. I do not see that this $1,000 amount was inflation adjusted. There was any provision for that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Can you talk a little bit about the reasoning in terms of formulating the legislation that way?
Sure. Through the chair, again, this I wanted to put forward an idea that was basically the most fiscally conservative, predictable dividend that I thought we could offer. And that's why there's not inflation adjustment in here yet. I don't have a strong fixed opinion that it shouldn't, but I wanted to do something that was very predictable for Alaskans, $1,000. And I think we can afford that right now with no new revenue.
Follow up, Representative Grove.
Thank you. If we inflation adjusted the past amounts, which I don't think I saw either, is that correct in terms of what the past amounts were shown?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Would it surprise you to note that there was a roughly $1,750 as an average over time in 2021 dollars?
Through the chair, no, and that $1,000 initial dividend would be higher.
No, but I mean
when inflation adjusted.
But the overall, counting all of them over time.
Through the chair, no, it would not surprise me.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, and I also have some more questions not to do with inflation, if you would indulge me.
Okay. Representative Grove.
Thank you. I wanted you to comment, Representative Fields, if you could, on sort of an overall philosophy, and this is in terms of schools of thought that we see within the Capitol, in terms of the fundamental question of who pays for the structural deficit, which also, in your account, would also have to include the very substantial loss and fall and decline in Alaska's oil production over time from the late 1980s until today. One school of thought is that the people who need to pay for the structural deficit are the permanent dividend recipients. Another school of thought might be that the people who need to pay are the people who use the roads in the schools in terms of having budget cuts only. And I'm interested more in how you saw, as a veteran legislator, various schools of thought of who should pay for the structural deficit.
Sure. Through the chair, I guess the first level of analysis is in 1976, voters put the permanent fund into the Constitution. I think they were very clear about turning a non-renewable resource into a renewable resource with the explicit intent of funding services. And I think that was a good idea. I also think it was a good idea when the legislature by statute established a permanent fund dividend program, and they did so with the governor with the intent of helping protect and grow that trust fund. In that hierarchy, the Constitution is Trump's statute, right? If there's a tension between them. So I think this bill is true to that. I also think the data are very clear that the permanent fund dividend has had a positive impact on ameliorating poverty. And I support that. At the same time, a lot of government services ameliorate poverty and give people opportunity to work hard and get ahead. And that was certainly true in my family. So I guess I don't see, public education and public safety and roads as necessarily competing with a dividend. They're all public goods. If you have a finite amount of money, we just have to balance between them. And now that we have four times less oil in the pipeline, which is really the key sort of environmental change, we have four times less oil in the pipeline. We can't, and that's really why we can't afford a 1982 level dividend. Barring a massive influx of new oil, and I fought hard for the Willow Project and Pickett and hope that those come online and hope we get more oil development. But, barring sustained very high oil prices or substantially higher oil taxes or some other substantial form of new revenue, we do have to balance the services and dividends, recognizing that the people who are most impacted are, you're working poor. And my district, contrary to popular perception, sometimes is actually poorer than average. So, I talk to people whose homes have been broken into multiple times because of inadequate policing. So I think a lot about that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Fields,
I would like to ask a question concerning the structure. And I understand your argument towards the establishing $1,000 is predictable. And it certainly does that. What would cause the legislature to follow that statute if it's a appropriation? Are we talking a shall appropriate or a may appropriate structure in the law?
Right.
And how does that actually get us to a more stable environment if it's still subject to appropriation?
Right. Chairman Carpenter, I think number one, because it's realistic without raising new revenue, we can. If we pass this bill, I would tell my constituents you are highly, highly likely to get $1,000 dividend most likely we're going to have oil prices where we can afford it. And even if they dipped slightly below your $63 or whatever it was, we would be able to dip into savings a little bit to pay for it. So I think the fact that it's realistic based on our budget projections is number one. Now the bill does leave intact our percent of market value spending cap. That I think that spending cap law is very important to protect the intent of the permanent fund itself. And I strongly support that spending cap. And God forbid we go back down to negative $3 per barrel oil, and then we have a bunch of hard decisions, right? And we still have to maintain that spending cap. But I think it's realistic, and we could stay committed to it. And that kind of honesty with voters is important.
Representative McCabe, you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Chair Carpenter. I have a question on three words, only three, in this bill. Page 2, line 12, at the very end of the sentence. Line 19, second to last word. In page 3, line 16, about middle of the page. May. It says may.
Yep.
Legislature may appropriate. Legislature may appropriate. And again, the legislature may appropriate.
Representative McCabe, I'm happy to defer to Ledge Legal on why they wrote it that way. But again, this law is intended to work in sync with our percent of market value spending cap. But if Ledge Legal is on the line, I might punt to them about why they wrote it the way they did.
Let me see if Ms. Nauman is with us. I think she might be. Ms. Nauman, are you online with us tonight?
Yes.
So the question's been posed as to why the bill includes may appropriate. Can you speak to why it was drafted that way?
Sure. For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. And the bill, and likely all the bills that you'll see tonight, are drafted in that way because it's consistent with the Supreme Court holding in the Willikowski case, which held that the appropriation for dividends is not mandatory. In other words, that the legislature is free to appropriate any amount for dividends in any given year. So the language, changing the language from shall to may, just makes the law consistent with that holding. And I would say that even if, and as the statutes are drafted now with that word shall, the legislature is still free to appropriate whatever amount they want for dividends. So this change just makes consistent the statute with our Supreme Court interpretation of the Alaska Constitution.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Representative McCabe, you have a follow-up.
Thanks. So Ms. Nauman, it's Representative McCabe. Then why do we even need this? The legislature can appropriate however much they want at any time or not appropriate it. I mean, one would think that the courts, the Supreme Court, if we put shall in there instead of may, and I get that we can violate the law anytime we want, apparently, according to them, but wouldn't it strengthen it to put shall in there and make it a little bit less likely that a legislature would attempt to circumvent that language?
Again, for the record, this is Emily, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair. I don't believe so. The current language says shall, and the legislature has consistently chosen not to appropriate the amount spelled out in the formulas in those sections.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fields.
I'm fine putting shall if it more clearly communicates, which I think it does. And this one, I think we could actually honor the commitment.
Okay. Well, maybe we will consider that as an amendment to the legislation.
Well,
Representative McCabe.
So thanks, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to get that on the record, Ms. Nauman. So I appreciate it. Thanks.
Representative McKay, do you have a question?
Yes. McKay, right?
McKay.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Chairman Carpenter, through the chair. I just have a couple questions for the representative. Thank you for being here tonight. Thanks for putting this together. Actually, very interesting table. I'm not sure that in your fifth paragraph of your of the introduction, it says pay $1,000 PFD, the historic average taking into account inflation. If I understood my good friend Representative Grohl correctly, the inflation adjusted average is $1,750. Isn't that what you said? So
through the chair, you're right. That's a typo.
That's a typo. Okay. Well, then I guess I've contributed everything I need to tonight.
And for the record, we are talking about the sponsor statement, not the bill itself.
Okay. So that should be just for everybody's clarity, it should be $17.50.
We'll get that corrected, Representative McKay. Thank you.
Okay, so one observation I have, if you're going to hold it flat forever, it'll get eroded by inflation. Much like we're hearing from the education community about their famous pencil chart. So if you'd like to receive a dividend in Alaska that's adjusted for inflation, you would be upset, just like the education community is, about the erosion of their BSA. So I just think we should point that out. And this discussion also reminds me of the vote that I think was taken in 1994, where Alaskans resoundedly voted that we should not use the permanent fund to balance the state budget. I don't know if I have my year right, but I remember that vote, and I don't know if it would be much different today. So I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I don't know if Legislative Finance Division is online and has modeled out inflation adjusting $1,000 to 10 years into the future, how that might affect the oil prices at which we could afford services. But personally, I'd be supportive of inflation indexing. I think that would make sense. Yes. Like I said, I was putting forward basically a very fiscally conservative dividend bill, and I'm certainly open to ideas on it.
As we were talking previously about the inflation numbers on the past payments, I was thinking to myself, it would be nice to see those numbers, and the public, I'm sure, would like to see those as well. But I don't think that we have Legislative Finance or a presentation ready for that. So maybe we'll have that conversation at another meeting. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I liked the idea of doing the energy rebate because it is tax-free. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about any restrictions that we might have on how big that can be since it is tax-free, and you know, if we can afford it, how high can we go?
Yeah, through the chair, you could make an argument we should pay $100 dividend and everything else should be an energy rebate. But I don't think the IRS, to my knowledge, has provided guidance going forward on how regularly we can do that or under what conditions or how large. So I just don't think we have the information to say.
And I'm not sure whether that's a qualified opinion or just your personal opinion. Maybe we can do some research and find out from the IRS. Okay. It has been brought up here, so we will research that for the committee's edification. Representative McCain.
If you don't mind, thanks, Chair. More of a comment for further research is the hold harmless portion that not too many people, I didn't know about it before I got down here, where people are held harmless. We pay the federal government a certain amount of money based on the PFD for people that would normally have to pay tax on that, but they don't. And it would be interesting to kind of explore that. I've heard it's a $20 million savings if we just rename the PFD for the hold harmless portion. So, and I'm not even sure I can explain the mechanics of how it works, so it might be helpful.
That's a good point, Representative McCabe. Both the energy rebate and the hold harmless are going to, you know, have a tangential impact on decisions that we make with regard to the PFD. So we will do the research and present that to the committee so that we're all on the same page. Are there any other questions here? Representative Groh, you have another question.
I can, since hold harmless has been brought up, say, Representative Fields, because I learned to couch these things in form of questions. Did you know that in 1982, one of the more difficult parts of putting together the permanent fund dividend bill was to create a hold harmless provision to prevent some people who otherwise would have lost money if they'd gotten a dividend, the way the federal laws worked? And that was actually one of the most challenging parts of the legislation for some legislative staff member with brown hair and a much thinner body to work on at the time. That there are people who, under certain circumstances, would actually lose money by getting the dividend if the home harmless provisions were in effect. Are you aware of that?
I, through the chair, I was aware of hold harmless, but not that element of the legislative history. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Fields, you guys had a great presentation. I would like to make it available for the record. Would you be able to make the slide presentation available to our staff?
And through the chair, I think your staff should have it in our inbox.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And I will thank you for coming and presenting today. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside and take it up at another time. And we will have public testimony on this bill this next Saturday at 9 a.m. Okay. Next up, I would like to bring my staff, Kendra Broussard, up, and we're going to introduce committee bill HJR 7. We'll take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record, and we are going to present committee bill, committee resolution, House Joint Resolution 7. And I would like to ask my committee staff, Kendra Broussard, to put herself on the record and give us a sponsor statement and a sectional analysis.
Through the chair, my name is Kendra Broussard, staff representative Carpenter. I will start off by doing the sponsor statement for House Joint Resolution 7. For almost 30 years, Alaskans could count on their annual dividends checks at the state legislature followed the law that directed the dividend to be paid by a statutory formula. The trust between the government and the people of Alaska was broken in 2016 when Governor Walker vetoed a portion of the annual dividend, and the Alaska Supreme Court ultimately determined that dividends were subject to the annual appropriations process. While this separate is from the budget, they have not done so. Instead, the permanent fund dividend has been subjected to the budget process, where the dividend competes with government spending and often becomes deficit reduction solution. HJR 7 requires the state to pay the annual permanent fund dividend according to a formula and statute rather than by the whims of the annual appropriations process. The amendments in HJR 7 address the constitutional issues raised by the Supreme Court in its Wilikowski opinion that allowed the legislature to appropriate the annual dividend rather than pay it out by formula. Neglecting to constitutionalize the PFD would permit lawmakers to continue avoiding their obligation to address the shortcomings of Alaska's fiscal and economic planning, placing the permanent fund at risk. Constitutionally enshrining the permanent fund dividend will provide for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans and ensure the prosperity of the permanent fund for generations of Alaskans to come.
Thank you, Ms. Broussard. Let's go over the sectional analysis quickly.
So Section 1, well, Article 9, Section 7 of the Constitution of Alaska is amended to accept the payment of permanent fund dividends from the prohibition of dedicated funds. And then in Section 2 of the bill, the resolution, Article 9, Section 13 of the Constitution of Alaska is amended to accept the payment of permanent fund dividends from the requirements to appropriate all funds that are paid out of the state treasury. Then continuing on through Section 4, the Article 9, Section 15 of the Constitution of Alaska is amended to require the state to pay a permanent fund dividend according to a formula in law. Section 5 goes on to say Article 15 of the Constitution is amended to add a new transition section that would make the constitutional changes effective for fiscal year 2026. Section 6 provides that this amendment to the Constitution be placed before voters at the next general election.
Thank you, Ms. Broussard. Comments or questions from the committee? Representative McCabe.
So I notice this one is different in that it uses the word shall on line page 2, line 13, each fiscal year. Without appropriation, the state shall pay a dividend. So hence my earlier question is, I'd like to sort of juxtapose the two where there's one is a change to statute and one is a change to constitution. Thank you.
Ms. Nauman, are you still on the line?
Yes.
So I would like to pose this question to you, comparing the previous bill that we just heard and this resolution. What is the effect of the word shall being in this resolution?
For the record, this is Emily, Legislative Legal Services, Chair Carpenter. This is a constitutional amendment. So
The Wilkowski fee state decision was an interpretation of the Constitution as it exists today. Under that interpretation, statutes must, or transfers, excuse me, appropriations for dividends must be made by the legislature and are subject to a legislative appropriation cycle each year. Because this resolution is changing the Constitution, it doesn't have to abide by that Wilkowski v. State decision. It is, in fact, amending those very sections that the Alaska Supreme Court interpreted to require an appropriation. And so it is permissible here for the changes to use the word shall.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Was it, refresh my memory, was it written in the Wilkowski case as the what the justices said that, or recommended or identified that a constitutional amendment would be necessary if the legislature wanted to dedicate money to the permanent fund dividend?
Again, Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services, for the record. I don't recall that that holding specifically saying anything about a constitutional amendment.
Okay, thank you. Questions? No questions. Representative Groh.
Hi. Thank you, Madam. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Chair Carpenter. This particular constitutional proposal just requires the payment of a dividend, and obviously, just want to make sure we put this on the record, does not set out a formula unlike another proposal. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Representative McCabe?
Well, I think just a comment, going back to the Fiscal Policy Working Group, we had hours of discussion over putting a formula in the Constitution, both with Ledge Legal and with Ledge Finance, and I think we landed in the middle saying we should put something in there like this that said we shall pay a dividend and then put the formula in statute and make it, you know, the people could vote on it or however we wanted to do that. So I think this is exactly what the Fiscal Policy Working Group said we wanted, if I'm not mistaken.
Representative McCabe, I would just dialogue on that for a second. Why? What were the two positions, if I could sum it up to two positions, as to why there was a compromise to say put something in the Constitution, maybe not the number or formula or whatnot? What was the reasoning behind why it had to be in the Constitution in the first place?
Well, I think because of the word shall, frankly. I mean, you know, because the what I just asked the first question for the first bill, which it said may, and Ms. Nauman said that even if it said shall, we could still violate it. And the people, my constituents certainly had told me that they wanted it in the Constitution. And frankly, they wanted a formula in the Constitution. They wanted the whole thing in the Constitution. I became convinced after much dialogue, as I'm sure you did as well, with the Fiscal Policy Working Group and with Ledge Legal and Ledge Finance, that having a formula in the Constitution is not only problematic, but could be dangerous for us in some sort of a major downturn or oil price crash or any number of fiscal issues. It could be dangerous. So this was the compromise we reached, just put it in the form in the Constitution, because in the Constitution, you can use the word shall, and we have to follow.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Ms. Nauman, I'd like to pose a question to you in regards to how easily the legislature would be able to ignore the statute that's created that this resolution would refer to. Because this resolution doesn't actually speak to what the dividend would be or what the program would look like or percentage of market value or anything like that. It just says that there's going to be a statute that defines what the dividend would be. What would be the legislature's ability to ignore that statute given this resolution?
Again, for the record, this is Emily, Legislative Legal Services. you know, it's difficult to predict with absolute certainty how the Alaska Supreme Court is going to interpret any portion of the Constitution or statute. But I would say with confidence that if this resolution were passed, the Supreme Court would require the legislature to appropriate money for dividends according to the statute and formula. The formula and statute. I guess the one caveat for that is that the Supreme Court doesn't really have an absolute mechanism to make that appropriation happen, but I would like to think that the legislature would comply with the Supreme Court decision in that case.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. I guess I'd like to have just a little bit more understanding of that last statement that you said as the mechanism to make it happen. What is that? What do you mean by that?
Again, for the record, Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. I guess what I mean is that the court can't make an appropriation themselves. The legislature must make the appropriation ultimately. So if the court orders the legislature to make an appropriation, you would hope, and I would always advise, that the legislature make that appropriation. And it's a bit unclear what would happen if they didn't.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. I appreciate it. Representative Groh, you have a question.
I do. And I think it's probably for Ms. Nauman, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Ms. Nauman, in some of these proposals, I have seen language that says that the, in the Constitution, proposed Constitution amendments that say that the legislature shall pay a dividend pursuant to a statute that is not an appropriations bill or the budget. Could you explain for the committee the legal difference there and how that would work in terms of the, you know, because this language, for example, in this resolution just says each fiscal year without appropriation, the state shall pay a dividend from the income of the permanent fund of the eligible residents of states, eligible residents of the state according to a formula set out in law. But then the alternative that I have seen, it's one that says according to a formula set out in law or statute that is not an appropriations bill or the budget. Could you explain the difference, please, between those two kinds of proposals?
For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services, from the chair. The language that you're talking about that states that the dividend shall be paid as provided by law that is not an appropriation bill is sort of an insurance, if you will, because an appropriation bill is law. So simply saying that a dividend shall be paid according to state law in this case is not necessarily sufficient to ensure that the legislature will pay dividend according to a set formula because an appropriation bill is law. So it could be argued that that law, the appropriation bill, is sufficient to meet that statutory requirement or that constitutional requirement. In this case, I think the language in this resolution by requiring the state to pay a dividend according to formula, don't see it having the same issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, my understanding is that this would force us, you know, would require us to pay a dividend, which we always have since we started doing dividends. And I guess my question is, and I don't know if I'm allowed to ask it, because I know the next bill we're going to talk about will sort of set what the dividend would be. But right now, if we only did this one, then it would just say that we have to do what we've already been doing. Is that a correct assessment? Like, they would just say that we have to pay a dividend.
Ms. Nauman, I guess to help Representative Gray with a question, I think it was clear to me, but I guess maybe another way to ask the question is, if this resolution were to pass, would there be required an additional piece of legislation to make it effective, or would current legislation fit within the resolution?
I'll get the answer to that, and then I'll clarify.
Again, Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. Unfortunately, there's not a very straightforward answer to your question, because currently the statutes governing the amount paid for a dividend based on a fiscal situation could conflict. So if this resolution were to pass, I would suggest that the legislature clean up the existing dividend statute. To Representative Gray's question, the difference with this resolution is that under the current constitution and statute, if the legislature decided at some point to stop paying a dividend, it could. Under this resolution and amendment to the constitution, the legislature would be required to pay a dividend for into the future, for until the constitution is subsequently changed.
Thank you. I think my follow-up,
go ahead.
My follow-up would be that if we only did this resolution, I mean, the legislature could change the statute at any time. And so basically this is, like you just said, just meaning us to pay a dividend, whether it be $1 or, but it would just, we'd have to pay something.
Yeah, I think so. Ms. Nauman.
Again, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. Yes, that's correct. In any given year, the legislature could pass an appropriations bill paying a dividend and pass a, you know, statutory change changing the formula so that the dividend is a mere matter of cents if it wanted to.
Ms. Nauman, a question, a follow-up to that train of thought. If the resolution before us tells us that without appropriation, the state shall pay a dividend from a statute that's established, what would be the effect if the legislature attempted to pay a dividend through the appropriations process instead? Is there going to be a conflict between the statute that's on the books and the appropriations bill that the legislature is attempting to pay something different than what the statute says?
Sure. For the record, again, Emily, Legislative Legal Services. And I apologize, I misspoke in my answer to the previous question. I had forgotten that this resolution doesn't require an appropriation. It's a transfer, a mandatory transfer that would happen without appropriation. So I think we would hope that situation wouldn't happen, but I think the legislative intent related to that appropriation would have to make clear whether or not it was the intent of legislature to be appropriating for that transfer, which would be legally maybe very confusing, or to make an appropriation on top of what that transfer already was.
Representative Grove.
To the chair, thank you, Chair Carpenter. Ms. Nauman, I also wanted to ask, in the context of the constitutional amendments, of the risk or your assessment of any risk that any constitutional amendment that we're considering in this committee might run afoul of the doctrine that the last Supreme Court announced in the case of Best versus Ulmer involving revision versus amendment. Could you talk a little about that, about what that doctrine is and how that might affect this committee's consideration of constitutional amendments?
Sure. For the record, again, Emily, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair, to Representative Grow. There are two ways to amend the Constitution set out in the last Constitution. The first is by amendment, which is the process that you're looking at in front of you, a resolution followed by a vote of the people. Another way to amend the Constitution is through a constitutional convention. And the Supreme Court has said that if changes to the Constitution are large enough, that they're the sweeping changes that require some rebalance of government structure, that those changes will have to go or must go through the constitutional convention process, and then they cannot be performed through a revision. The court's analysis in Best was two-pronged. They look at the qualitative, that is the number of changes, and the quantitative, that is the quantitative, that's the number of changes, and the qualitative, that's the nature of the changes in terms of rebalancing the government powers. For each of these constitutional amendments related to the permanent fund, I think the real driver of the determination of whether or not the amendment would constitute a revision, in my mind, is how much it impairs the legislature's current very broad appropriation authority over all of the money that's coming from the permanent fund. So the most powerful part of the legislature is its power of appropriation, right? So when I see resolutions, constitutional amendments that come across my desk that take giant portions of the state's revenue out of the control and authority of the legislature to appropriate, those are the kinds of resolutions that I think of as more likely to trigger a determination by the Supreme Court that they constitute a revision that cannot be done by amendment. That said, all of that said, we only have one case on this issue, as Representative Gross said, that's Beth, the owner, and that case doesn't provide us a lot of guidance in these circumstances related to the permanent fund dividend. So it's all a bit of a question mark in the end, unfortunately.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. I don't see any other questions. So we will go ahead and set this bill aside and move on to the next. We will set this resolution aside. And we will also take up public testimony on this resolution on this coming Saturday. So without further ado, let's move to the next order of business, House Joint Resolution 8.
Through the chair, Kendra Bussar, staff representative Carpenter. So House Joint Resolution 8, I'll read the sponsor statement for that as well. For almost 30 years, Alaskans could count on their annual dividend checks as the state legislature followed the law that directed the dividend to be paid by a statutory formula. The trust between the government and the people of Alaska was broken in 2016 when Governor Walker vetoed a portion of the annual dividend, and the Alaska Supreme Court ultimately determined that dividends were subject to the annual appropriations process. While the legislature could choose to follow the law and appropriate the dividend according to statute and separate it from the budget, they have not done so. Instead, the permanent fund dividend has been subjected to the budget process, where the dividend competes with government spending and often becomes a deficit reduction solution. House Joint Resolution 8 aims to enshrine the PFD program in the Alaska Constitution to create stability for Alaskans who rely on their annual dividend, and to create stability for the long-term fiscal plan of the state. Without stability, those who receive state funding through the dividend or from government programs cannot plan for their businesses or their lives for a duration of more than a year. HJR 8 adds protection against overspending of the fund by moving the balance of the earning reserve account, which currently holds the permanent fund's investment earnings, into the fund's corpus, where all future earnings will be retained and thereby safeguarded from access. HJR 8 then limits the permissible draw from the fund to 5% of a 5-year average market value of the fund. The people would then be apportioned either 50% of the draw value or the amount of the historic calculation formula, whichever is greater. In this way, the people will always receive first call on the earnings of the fund ahead of government. Failing to constitutionalize the PFD would enable a disproportionate distribution of Alaska's oil wealth to growing government at the expense of Alaska citizens. Neglecting to constitutionalize the PFD would permit lawmakers to continue avoiding their obligations to address the shortcomings of Alaska's fiscal and economic planning, placing the permanent fund at risk. Constitutionally enshrining the permanent fund dividend will provide for the maximum benefit of all Alaskans and ensure the prosperity of the permanent fund for generations of Alaskans to come.
Thank you, Mr. Sard. Can you move to the sectional analysis, please?
So we have in Section 1, it eliminates the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund. All income of the permanent fund that is not directed to the dividend payment or to the general fund shall be retained in the corpus of the permanent fund. And Section 2, Article 9, Section 15 of the Constitution is amended to provide for a draw from the permanent fund of 5% of the market value, the OMB, of the fund. Section 2 then requires the state to pay a permanent fund dividend that is greater of two calculations, the traditional PFD calculation or 50% of the 5% POMV. The remainder of a 5% POMV may be appropriated by the legislature for state government. Section 3 states Article 15 of the Constitution is amended to provide for transitioning timing of effective actions once voters approve the amendment to the Constitution. At the end of fiscal year 2025, the balance of the earnings reserve account would be transferred into the corpus of the fund. The substantive provisions would be effective beginning fiscal year 2026. Section 4 provides that this amendment to the Constitution be placed before voters at the next general election.
Thank you, Ms. Broussard. So here is a resolution that's quite different than in effect from the previous resolution. We have comments or questions from the committee. Representative Groh.
First of all, I want to thank the chair, Mr. Chair, for putting forward these resolutions. And I would note that this one accomplishes a goal of constitutionalizing the percent of market value rules and creating a single account structure, something that I'm obviously very much in favor of and, of course, helped bring forward in a proposal myself today. I would also note that this proposed resolution, this proposed constitutional amendment set out in this resolution would have, beyond constitutionalizing the PMMD rules, would also, of course, set out a formula or alternative formulas and as a way of what the dividend would be in future years. I guess I could ask the testifier or perhaps you would address this, Chair Carpenter. It does not include revenues. It's frequently said that if you have a 50-50 split or allocation between dividends and general government of the percent of market value draw of the permanent fund earnings, that creates a hole. Senate Finance Committee has recently estimated that at perhaps $800 million a year. And I wondered whether if you wanted to address sort of the philosophical or practical or policy question of not addressing revenues in this proposal of HCR 8.
Well, I will take that question. I don't think that HCR 8 as drafted was the intention was to address revenue options at all. I think the intent of the committee here, the process going forward, is to address revenues if necessary with other pieces of legislation and model both of them or all of these propositions before us to see how they interact with each other. So I think it would be kind of premature to have a conversation based on what might have been presented in other committees tonight without being able to reference the documents or the numbers. But just to say that this resolution dealing with a way to deal with the PFD was not ever intended to deal with the one of the other areas of a fiscal policy working group recommendation, which was new revenues. So it only deals with one of those pieces.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up with you about that.
Sure.
The fiscal policy working group, and by the way, I commend the members, as I individually commended individual members and would do so again. There are obviously some members of the fiscal policy working group sitting on this committee tonight. I commended you for your work, which also included a variety of proposals. As you have said, you devoted the first meeting of this committee to those proposals. And there were, of course, a number of proposals along with a recommendation or a strong recommendation that there be an approach that had simultaneous and comprehensive solution. But I just wanted to say again that I do think it's worth it as the committee goes forward to recognize that if you choose to put in a formula of this kind in the Constitution, which, by the way, I've said before that I support and ran on of a 50-50 allocation, you need to have revenues to be able to prevent schools, roads, public health, and public safety from being starved or damaged. And that's why, of course, the Fiscal Policy Working Group came up with a recommendation of revenues between $500 million and $775 million a year in its report back in 2021. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Groh. And I would just say that is one way to look at it. Another way might be that we need economic growth within the state that would provide some sort of new revenue to the state. Obviously, one of those things might be an increase in oil price or oil production. Another one might be some other economic growth that has yet to materialize. But that would be another way to look at it and not just anyway. Representative McCabe.
So thank you, Chair Carpenter. This also was something we talked about, eliminating the ERA, which is essentially what this does. But as far as the revenue piece, which we sort of have on the table right now, and notwithstanding your dentist, we looked at every former dentist. We looked at every at the revenue piece in the fiscal policy working group, and there is no possible way, barring a huge income tax, that the citizens of Alaska can come up with the revenue shortfall through a tax structure. There's just not. We must generate new revenues, whether it be Willow or something else. So an income tax structure we looked at extensively, and it just doesn't work with our tax base.
Representative Crow.
Chair. The Alaska House of Representatives passed a bill to create an income tax that raised $700 million in 2017. That was the estimate of the Alaska Department of Revenue. I would also note that I, like other legislators, proud to support the Willow Project and voted for a resolution to have that go forward. I do have the advantage, being the chronologically advantaged person that I am, as Mr. Gray's, Representative Gray's, I'll point out on the floor, that I have seen a lot of things over time, including a lot of promises about development projects, raising revenues. I'm all for it. I do think, as Mr. Representative McCabe has pointed out, that if you put a formula in the Constitution to require certain payment of dividends, which would be an effective and legally enforceable provision, as Ms. Nauman has pointed out, advised us, that you have to have a way to make sure that that will work. In terms of the revenues, to avoid starving the public services, like giving us crummy roads, crummy schools, crummy public safety. I very much look forward to working with other members of the committee and other legislators to help avoid that kind of bad outcome.
Thank you, Representative Groh. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can you talk about the decision to pair the elimination of the earnings reserve account with a fixed formula for the PFD?
So one of the Representative Gray, and this is Chair Carpenter for the record, two of the recommendations from the Fiscal Policy Working Group, one of them was consolidating to a single fund source style of permanent fund, so eliminating the earnings reserve account. And the other one was constitutionalizing or making permanent the permanent fund program. So putting both of them in a resolution that deals with both of those is the way to do that, and that is why they're both found in this resolution. I would also say that this resolution is pretty much identical to Senate Joint Resolution 1 that was sponsored in the other body as well. Representative Allard.
I'm not sure if I say through the chair.
To the chair.
To the chair. So are we kind of discussing it amongst ourselves right now? May I ask a question to Representative Groh?
Yes, you may.
Just for clarification.
He's not on the hot seat here. I am as the chair, and this is a committee bill, so I'm answering the questions. But okay. I think Representative Groh would be amenable to a question.
So are you suggesting that because we have perhaps bad roads, horrible education system, that we swipe individuals' PFD before cutting the budget?
No. I'd like to tax my former dentist. I would like to I would also, although I'd like to look out for the views of people who make $20 and $25 an hour, despite the substantial pressures among other people that say, Cliff, you got to look out for the interests of people who make $2,000 an hour or $500 an hour. And so I represent a district, as which I told the constituent when I met with her on Saturday, people in my district are much more likely to have a second job than a second home. And she said, Representative Groh, who do you know who owns their first home? And I said, well, there's some people in the district, but a lot of people seem very interested in those interests of those people who have second homes. And I think that we need a balanced approach, like the Fiscal Policy Working Group with the fine members on this committee recommended back in 2021. And I'm working with all of them to help them reach, you know, that goal, which I thought was very impressive.
So the goal tonight was to hear three bills and discuss the merits of three separate bills, three separate and unique proposals. And the question that you pose is a very valid one, which we are going to get to when we see the other proposals, which are components of the Fiscal Policy Working Group. We'll be able to model those and have a conversation on how they react. You may, Representative Allard, go right ahead.
So, yes, because I was upstairs working on a project and I came down a little bit late and I had heard Representative McKay state kind of like the pencil presentation with the
education, I think is what he was referring to.
I'm just looking at him. With the education, and I was just trying to make sure that figuring out if we're all on the same page here. That's all.
Okay. Well,
don't worry about me, right? I'm tired. I'm sorry. But yeah.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. So through the chair to the chair. I'm a newer legislator, so I'm constantly trying to reconcile all the bills we've heard if in the unlikely event that they all passed. And so when I think about the 75-25, the 1,000 PFD, these two constitutional amendments, I know the constitutional amendments would trump whatever else we did, what it, those statutory things. But I guess they can't all be reconciled together. And the spending cap. I was also trying to reconcile the spending cap in there as well. How can you see the legislation we've heard so far all working together? Maybe that's the question.
That's good. That's a good question, Representative Gray. So one of the criticisms of the Fiscal Policy Working Group report was that it was just a theoretical recommendation. It wasn't a bill or a resolution to take to have action by the legislature. The report or the Fiscal Policy Working Group could have, if they wanted to, come up with a recommendation for a piece of legislation and submit that to the legislature to consider, right? As it is, the legislature has got a lot of opinions. The only way we actually get to action is by a bill or a resolution. That's how we act. And so what we are attempting to do in Ways and Means is bring the action options so that we're actually talking about something that we can do and it's not just theoretical, okay? I don't envision that we will pass all of these bills because some of them are competing and they do different things. What we are going to do, I hope, is pick something that we can agree on to head in a certain direction and then set the other stuff aside. And so the intent in the future, in the weeks to come, is that we'll use a tool that legislative finance has and plug each one of these in at a time and see how they react or relate to each other. So a spending cap and HDR 8 and a spending cap and HDR 7. And we'll be able to see how they work together. And then at the end of that exercise, then we should have a suite of bills that fit into the categories that we've talked about previously as something that we can take action on. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Groh?
Chair, I think you mean a suite of measures because some would be bills and some would be constitutional resolutions setting out constitutional amendments, perhaps.
That's correct. I stand corrected. Thank you. Appreciate it. Speaking of history on Fiscal Policy Working Group, I would like to have some invited testimony right now. Representative Shelley Hughes is in the audience. I'm sorry, Senator Shelley Hughes is in the audience, and I would like to bring her up. Shelley, Representative Hughes, I've done that twice. It is late. Senator Hughes participated in the Fiscal Policy Working Group, and Senator Hughes has also participated in a PFD working group prior to the Fiscal Policy Working Group. And I want to ask her to share some of her thoughts and, on now that we have measures before us, which were things that were lacking from both of the experiences that you had before, share your thoughts on kind of what is before us today.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter, and thank you and good evening to the members, the speaker. I'm Shelley Hughes, and I serve District M in Mat-Su. And indeed, I was in 2019, I was part of the Bicameral Permanent Fund Working Group, which had a report in January 2020. And then I was on the Fiscal Policy Working Group with you, Mr. Chair, and we released our report in August 2021. And looking over the bills and thinking about the topic, and it goes a bit to Representative Gray's question is about how you do this, how do we bring this all together. I'll just make the point, I think we did talk about it when I spoke to your committee before, is that all the pieces have to hinge together. So this would have, once you get something passed, it doesn't go into effect till the other piece gets passed, et cetera. That's part of how you can do it. And, you know, some of the things are bills, and they only require 11 and 21. Some of them are resolutions, which require 14 and, is it 26 in there, or 27, 26?
26, I think.
26. So, and to me, the bookend pieces are the ones that go in the Constitution. First of all, they're more difficult to pass, but then they determine what you need, what you have left over for your budget. And that's when you have the revenue and reduction question. So the first two, the bookends, the parameters, are the constitutional pieces, which are settling the PFD and the spending cap. And that gives you the framework, and then you can get the other pieces done. One of the things as you're considering resolutions, Mr. Chair, and I was always the one to kind of wave the flag out there way back in 2019, is whatever you put forward has to meet the approval of the people. So, you know, some of us might want, a $500 PFD. Some of us might want an $8,000 PFD. But you've got to have something that's going to pass the people. And, of course, as we know, as the appropriators, it's got to work. The pieces have to fit together so that we can maintain our constitutional duty as far as the budget. So, but making sure whatever we have seems fair to the people, you have to keep that in mind. Now, that's one of the reasons why I like the resolutions that actually go ahead and say what the PFD is going to be. However, I will say, if you can only get the votes in this building on what shall be determined by law, I feel slightly more comfortable with that in 2023 than I did way back when this craziness, crazy merry-go-round began, which, when was that, 2016? Because now we've seen, for more than 8 years, nobody's passed a bill that changes, has repealed the old and put in a new formula. So we're, as legislators, and this was being talked about before 2016, nobody has been brave enough. We haven't been able to get 21 and 11 to change the formula. So that tells me if you had something that said by determined by law, I don't think it would willy-nilly change everywhere every year. I think legislators, just like us right now and future decades in time, they'd be hesitant to mess with it. So I don't think it would be constantly changing. However, in the Constitution provides super certainty, and that's what this is about, and I think that's what the chair is and you all are interested in, is fiscal certainty. And the importance of that pertains to our economy. And here we are right now. We're concerned about recruitment, retention challenges with our workforce, our public employees. We're concerned about the schools having funding. But you know what? If we have these workers with these wonderful things that keep them in their jobs, and we have wonderful schools, and kids are going through and graduating, but we don't have an economy, we don't have fiscal certainty, and we don't have jobs, what's the point? The young people are going to leave, and you know, the public employees, who are they going to have left to serve? So we're kind of backwards as far as what we're working on. We should be working towards fiscal certainty first. It should be a priority. So I thank you for your leadership, Mr. Chair, in working on that. I also want to take you back in history a little bit. I don't think we talked about this last time, but as you read about the history, and I know Representative Groh was part of some of that, but Milton Friedman was consulted about what to do as far as the permanent fund, because there were all kinds of things being weighed. Should we put it all in capital budget? You know, what, how should we do this? He was the actually one that recommended getting some out into the private sector. And he explained it this way. Anything that goes into the budget, whether it's operating or capital, ultimately is serving some special interest group. And not all special interest groups are bad. So, for instance, money that goes to the Department of Fish and Game is helping those that like to hunt and fish, right? But it is a special interest. And he said by doing a permanent fund, you're getting away from that, and everybody is treated equally, and everybody's getting in. You're getting the money because a dollar in the private sector economy has a higher multiplier than in the government sector. So just keep in mind, he was a pretty brilliant fellow, and I think his advice stands today because it's based on principle. So one of the things that I did, just to give you, and I'll just go through it real quickly, is I went through the document that Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins and I worked on that came out in January 2021, and it was regarding a larger PFD. So at the time, it would have been the statutory at 3,000. So I think when you're looking at HCR 8, you were talking about a more sizable PFD. So I think this is pretty applicable, some of these things and the data that we pulled. And we're kind of, both of us, JKT, representative, former representative, Christ-Tompkins, I'm a little bit nerdy, and we got over, and we spent hours on this. But some of the data that we pulled up, first of all, you're increasing Alaskans' income, and with a 3,000 PFD, it gets between $2.5 and $3 billion out in income, raises the income of Alaskan. It had positive impacts to between 10,000 and 17,000 jobs. It raised the income, took people out of poverty between 36,000 and 45,000 Alaskans taken out of poverty. Fascinating that the probability of employment, if you were to give a larger PFD like that, the probability of employment by Alaskan males goes up by 5.4%. Another interesting thing, a lot of people think that those large PFDs, it all goes to, you know, travel and people going to Hawaii. The studies, actually, this was all through ICER, was that about $750 out of a $3,000 PFD would go to non-durable goods, which would include food, entertainment, travel, et cetera. So that means $2,250 of that $3,000 PFD is actually going into things, you know, that people are that are durable, things that people are purchasing. So those I thought were pretty relevant. I also pulled up some material from when I had a meeting after the more recent working group, and we brought in ICER, and we brought in small business folks, the Kenai Peninsula, one of the small development workforce folks. We brought them in, and so I want to give you some information that also stresses the importance. So this was ICER, and basically I'm going to just read a few little segments that repeat the same thing. Increase in policy uncertainty followed the onset of the Great Recession had significant negative effects on aggregate investment, okay, and on employment. Here's another phrase. Economic policy uncertainty can explain up to 32% of the drop in corporate investment. I'm going to read another quick one. The decline in spending due to policy uncertainty would indicate that waiting is not a costless option. In fact, the losses due to uncertainty are important and similar in magnitude to the ones the economy would experience due to a tax or further government cuts. So waiting is not a good option. And then I do believe I did say this last time I was here, but I'm going to repeat it because it's important enough. And that is that the lack of having our fiscal house in order has been costing the state about $500 million a year each year if we haven't had it settled. Add that up over the years, sizable. Another thing from this presentation was when we talked about reducing poverty, particularly for Alaska Natives and elderly, was the most impact. Last, I want to mention how a PFD, a sizable PFD, impacts business, the business world. We had the UAA Business Enterprise Institute present to us from UAA, and startups, entrepreneurs that start businesses, They don't all run to the bank to get the capital they need to get started. 64% of them will go to family first. They will go to family savings, personal, and relatives. So if you have a sizable PFD, you're going to see more startups. And that same principle applies to expanding business. People that own their own business will tend to use those kind of funds also to expand their businesses. And that 23% of startup businesses start with $10,000 or less. If you have a family of four and you have a $3,000 PFD, that's $12,000. So you're gonna have some small business growth, which is kind of the heartbeat of our state. So in summary, I just want to say that if we settle the PFD issue, you're going to, number one, increase Alaskans' income, two, reduce poverty, three, improve health. I actually didn't read that one, but I think you all heard that. There's been studies that particularly it helps with birth size of babies and such, and the health of elderly. So increase Alaskans' income, two, reduce poverty, three, improve health, four, expand businesses, five, increase employment, am I on six? Six, increase jobs, and seven, increase private investment. Some really positive things. All of those are positive. Why would we not move towards fiscal certainty? We just certainly should do it. And if we're concerned about our children and education, if we're concerned about our public employees, we need to have fiscal certainty so that we actually have a future in a state where there's economic activity and a strong economic activity. So those are my comments, and I can speak specifically to the bill if you want me to. Is this similar to Senator Wilikowski's proposals, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Hughes. House Joint Resolution 8 is the Senate Joint Resolution 1.
Okay, thank you. I kind of spoke to it before that if you settle in the Constitution, it's even more certainty than if you do a determined by law type resolution. However, you know, as I said, 8 or 10 years, I wouldn't do the determined by law, and it would be my second choice. But I do think legislators are hesitant to tinker around with the formula. So
thank you. I appreciate you bringing the information forward, especially focused on economic growth. Your presentation there is something that I haven't seen in a while. Do you happen to have that on digits that we will be able to make it available to the general public?
Right. It's on the legislative website. We can get these documents to you.
Okay. We'll link up the staff afterwards, and we'll get it published with this evening's meeting so the general public can reference that again. Thank you. Do we have any questions? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Hughes. I was intrigued by the bigger babies and that in particular, the more jobs, all of that. We had a lot of presentations tonight, and we had one where they gave us every single dividend that we've had since 1982. So just as I glance through, I see that we've got some years that had pretty big PFDs. Do we have data that shows that after a really big PFD that we had bigger babies that year?
ICER did the study, so I'm sure they did. That's how they looked at it, I'm sure.
I would like to see that. I would like to see the study. Thank you so much.
Representative Groh.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Hughes, for this presentation. As someone who helped create the Permanent Dividend, I was happy to hear your listing of all these substantial benefits. I wanted to ask a little bit about some of your discussion of business development. I've talked to a number of business leaders, including some coming to my office and read studies about this. And they talk about the need for fiscal certainty in helping to make the economy grow. What I also hear from business leaders, and I'm curious if you heard this before, about they talk about the need for amenities, or let's call it basic services, like good roads, good schools, good public safety, as important factors in deciding where to locate businesses, where to grow businesses, and also as factors in helping to attract employees. Is that the kind of thing that you studied or researched or heard?
Yes, it is absolutely true. And at the same time, I think that's why the business community likes this comprehensive approach, because as well as they want to make sure that they're good schools and good roads, they want to make sure that we're not going to come after and throw slap big taxes on them. So it all fits together, and we want good services here in the state and appropriate, and yes.
I think that's an interesting conversation, because there, in my mind, it juxtaposes a good roads and good services, good police force, and what is the way to pay for that? Is it investment earnings, or is it economic growth? Which of those two things is it that we want for the future of Alaska? And that's kind of what we're trying to settle right now, is what is the most stable system to create? Is it just relying on earnings for the permanent fund, or is it doing things that grow our economy as a means to get good roads and good schools and good? So appreciate the work. Representative McCabe, looks like you have a question.
Sure. So thanks, through the chair. So two things. First off, we know from our discussions that private money or money in the private sector returns 9 times the amount. So you put a dollar out and it comes back to you 9 times because of job creation and the TV repairman and all of that stuff. Government money returns like 1.2 times. So I think the idea here, and this is the sort of the second point, is you create the jobs first, and then you have to create the roads. Because if you just throw the money out there at 1.2 times and build a whole bunch of beautiful roads and infrastructure and bridges and everything else, by the time you get all done with them, and it's a timing thing, a chicken and egg thing, if you will, by the time you get them all done, everybody's gone, and nobody can make the money to finish to pay for them. So I suspect, and it's you see it all over the world. You see it in Phoenix, Arizona. You know, the people come, the people move in, they build houses, they build these big, huge spec home developments, golf courses, and then everybody complains because there's no roads, and now they have to build the roads. But they have the tax base to do it, or they have the people base, or the spending base, or the revenue base, however you want to say it, to do it. So I think that the chicken and the egg discussion is going to be a big part of what we're going to do or going to do next.
And through the chair, just a remark in response. Right here at home, the crash in the 80s and empty houses, I mean, you have to have the economy to support those services. It's all together.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I support growing the economy. My fear in Alaska is that we grow the economy, we grow the economy, we grow the economy. If the economy is not sending some of that money to the government to pay for services, then no matter how big the economy gets, it's not going to help pay for services. And it was tax-based, I heard Representative McCabe say. I think certainly if the economy grows and that grows the tax base, and we had some sort of tax structure that funded our government, then the bigger the economy, the more money we have to build roads. But I think, you know, the problem we have is that we have that disconnect. I don't know how a larger economy will pay for roads, school, and police unless they're directly paying for it, if it's not somehow coming from Juneau. So that's what I'm trying to make sense of in my head.
It's a very good point, Representative Gray. The structure we have right now pays for our government services from our one-trick pony, largely, right? And so the problem that, it may be a few generations from now that we finally find some alternative to oil and we just don't need to pump oil out of the ground anymore. I think that's a long shot. But the point is that if Alaska is always going to be known for just oil and we don't have any other real economic economy, then we're kind of in a pickle. But if we want some other type of an economy, what would we do to incentivize that economic growth? And are there ideas out there to make that happen? We haven't been having that conversation in the legislature. And so to the extent that the Fiscal Policy Working Group has some recommendations for how to structure a state government fiscal plan in order to to incentivize or at least take the wet blanket off of, you know, the disincentives. I mean, we've got the ninth highest corporate income tax rate in the nation, right? For example, if you want to incentivize economic growth, then you wouldn't want to tax it at one of the highest rates in the nation. You would want businesses to have a positive atmosphere to come in and take risk for some sort of economic activity, just as an example. So I think you're exactly right. We're getting to the point where we have to have that conversation about what the structure needs to look like for the state that we want to have. If it's not a one-trick pony, we want other ponies in the corral, we got to have a different structure. I think in my mind I was channeling Representative Shaw because he thought I was growing ponies and not peonies a long time ago. So I can't believe that came out of my mouth. But anyway, thank you, Senator Hughes, for coming tonight. I appreciate it. Any other comments? Okay. Well, this concludes the business for tonight. There will be no Ways and Means Committee on this Wednesday, but we will have a committee meeting on Saturday, 9 a.m., where we will hear these bills and resolutions again and take public testimony. So without further ado, at 7:35, the House Ways and Means Committee is adjourned.